Television has changed how we watch sports. One of the people who's changed the way TV covers sports is my guest, Terry O'Neill. He got his start working for ABC Sports in 1972. As an ABC producer, he won two Emmys for his work with NCAA football and the 1980 Winter Olympics. From 1981 to 87, O'Neill was the head of CBS Sports, where he won two more Emmys as the producer of the NFL broadcasts. Now O'Neill heads his own TV production company, which produces the ESPN program The Sports Reporters. Terry O'Neill has written a new book called The Game Behind the Game, High Stakes, High Pressure in Television Sports. The presentation of sports on TV changed dramatically during the 15 years O'Neill was at the networks.
Football used to be covered with as few as five or six cameras, and that really changed in 1970 with the advent of Monday Night Football, where for the first time in prime time, ABC gave it a big look with 10 or 11 cameras, as many as five or six videotape machines. And it got to the point in the last Super Bowl I did where we had 23 cameras and 11 videotape machines. So there's virtually nothing you can't isolate with the level of facilities we enjoy now.
As the number of cameras have changed and you have more locations to put them in, has the whole idea of what to shoot changed also?
It changed, but slower than you'd think. As late as 1980, you might be stunned to find out that television production crews came to town and had no contact whatever with the coaches and players. They picked up their information in the newspapers and maybe from a public relations man. And on that basis, they had a very arm's-length view of the game, not an intimate view as we tried to instill with a new system in 1981. And now it is common procedure for all networks to do as we started in 81, and that is to have regular Saturday meetings the day before the game with coaches and players so you actually know which plays to expect and therefore which isolates to plot into your camera coverage.
So when you plot the isolates into your camera coverage, what exactly does that mean?
Well, there's a typewritten scheme that's three or four pages long that every cameraman and every videotape operator has. And it's very much like the coach's ready list that you see coaches carry on the sidelines. It has plays according to situation, down and distance, who has the ball, which direction the ball is moving, whether it's a scrimmage play or a punt play or a field goal or a kickoff. Short yardage versus an expected pass play. And according to those situations, everybody has an assignment on every play, and they go to it automatically just before the snap of the ball.
When you first started the system where the producers would meet with the coaches and players before a broadcast, were the coaches reluctant to reveal too much information, afraid that it might be shared with their opposing team?
They were just reluctant in general. You know, we were strangers in a strange land because television had never really shown this level of interest in the game, in the techniques of the game. Some coaches welcomed it because for years their decisions had been misrepresented on television, so they saw it as a chance to get some truth on the air for a change. But like any human endeavor, it took regular contact and a certain trust to build before we really got the most inside kind of information.
Getting back again to what the camera is shooting, I think it was your idea to pull back a little bit and shoot wider angles of the game.
Terry, it was, but not solely my idea. I can recall the earliest sessions I had with John Madden where we could sit for hours and hours in a coach's film room and watch the game as coaches watch it, which is to say, one shot with all 22 men available, visible on the screen, but projected onto an entire wall so that the players were large enough to be understandable. And when Madden said, why can't we show the game this way on television, I tried to explain, John, if we shrank this very large picture down to a 17-inch television screen, people could barely see the tiny ant figures running across their screens. But it occurred to me, if we had a device, a kind of a roadmap, to draw them a pattern, a pass pattern, or some sort of indicator as to which players to watch, that yes, we could shoot the game wider. And this was the genesis of the CBS chalkboard, as we called it.
Why don't you describe the CBS chalkboard?
It's a special monitor in the booth with an electronic stylus attached by a small wire. And it's a very simple device wherein the producer decides to use it on a given play. the director puts the chalkboard effect on the line, if you will, which activates Madden's stylus. He then picks up the stylus and draws and speaks at the same time, much as he used to do as a coach for 20 years with various football teams. And when he is finished, he hits a little button up there that erases his squiggles, and that's our cue then to roll the replay and let viewers see what he's just drawn.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Terry O'Neill, and for 15 years he worked for Network Sports as a producer for ABC, then as head of CBS Sports. Now he has his own independent sports TV production company, and he's written a new book called The Game Behind the Game, High Stakes, High Pressure in Television Sports. When you're producing a big sporting event, for instance, a football game, there's hundreds of decisions you have to make per broadcast. Let's go through what some of those typical decisions are. For instance, you have to decide, it's you as the producer, right, who decides when to run an instant replay.
Yeah, so take the most extreme of all cases where you're doing a Super Bowl and there are 11 videotape machines and you've decided in advance what will be fed to each of those machines on each of the 150 plays in a football game. The moment the play is over, it's imperative, actually even before the play is over, if you can make it that soon, it's imperative to make a decision about whether you want a replay, and if so, which one or ones, because the director needs to know and the commentators need to know immediately, as well as the videotape operators who must re-cue that tape to the start of the play.
So what criteria do you use for making that decision?
Terry, it becomes very intuitive and very instinctive, but the simplest way to say it is you ask yourself, if I were sitting at home watching this in my living room, is there an angle of this play I would like to see? And if I replay it, am I willing to sacrifice the live elements that will be buried under this videotape? Live elements being reaction of players and coaches on the field, a look at the clock, the number of timeouts remaining, all that sort of thing that can be fed to the viewer between plays rather than a replay.
What are some of the other risks of too many replays?
Oh, the real risk is that they become mundane, that they don't deliver any information. And after a while, especially with the video explosion of recent years where people are able to watch so many football games, if your telecast contributes to the clutter of too many replays, you only succeed in numbing the viewer through the course of a weekend. And believe me, there's enough chance to be numb even if everybody puts on nice spare telecasts.
Is it the producer who also decides when to cut for a commercial?
Yes, the league, the National Football League, provides a set of guidelines about when you're allowed to take commercials. But normally there are more opportunities than you need, and therefore, yeah, it's the producer who decides when to take them and when to pass.
So when do you decide to go for a commercial?
Well, you try to space them. You have your clients paying. At CBS, they were paying about $115,000 per 30 seconds for a commercial back in 1985, my last season. And you know that their message, in their terms, should be spread in as broad a spectrum of the clock as possible. So you try not to bunch them if you can avoid that. And then the other determinant is if there's a great live moment, perhaps after the home team has scored and the home fans are going bonkers, you try to save that and get that on the air as best you can and not bury it in a commercial.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also control to an extent how much talk there is from the commentators. Do you think that there should be a constant running commentary?
No, it's one of the real ills of our business is that a football game has become 3 hours of wall-to-wall filibuster anymore. And, you know, the game is so lovely in the stadium. It's punctuated so often by not just crowd roar, but various kinds of gasps and oohs and ahs and all kinds of reaction. The quarterback barking signals, a defensive player trying to react to that. So many lovely things that if we could only get our commentators to be quiet occasionally, you'd get to hear more frequently at home.
Let me put you on the spot and ask you for an example of a bad judgment call that you made during a big game.
I'll tell you about one in my very first Super Bowl, Cincinnati and San Francisco, which was the highest rated game ever, the fourth highest rated television program in history and the highest rated sports event ever. In the third quarter, San Francisco, which had a big lead, was starting to lose ground to Cincinnati, hadn't made a first down through the whole quarter. And just at the end of the quarter, Joe Montana threw a pass to Mike Wilson, who was right on the sideline. Now, this was on the days before television replay actually could be used to reverse a call. But still, there was great curiosity on the viewer's part about whether he had both feet in bounds or not. And that was the primary question to answer. And I didn't. I went to another replay to show, to a chalkboard replay, to show another facet of the play. And the moment I did it, I wanted to take it back because in a Super Bowl, a play like that is discussed and rediscussed and hashed over for weeks and weeks after, and you dare not let a moment that might be controversial pass without adjudicating it.
This is an example of learning a lesson the hard way. What were the consequences of your decision?
Surprisingly, a few. The game didn't turn on that play, which is always it's a great fear that television sports producers live with, is that the game will turn, as the New York-Denver Super Bowl did 3 years ago, on a play that was not properly replayed by CBS, a play that should have been reversed, a John Elway to Clarence Kay pass. And the poor guys involved in that at CBS have lived with that that frustration for many years now.
In your new book, you talk about the importance of mythologizing the game of football. Why is that important?
It was important, Terry, in order to sell the National Football Conference, because the American Conference was available at the very same time, just across the dial on NBC. And for most viewers, the league is seen as a collective, as just pro football. And what we wanted to do was take the very most attractive teams in our conference, namely the 49ers, the Bears, the Dallas Cowboys, and mythologize them to a degree that they were actually seen as a kind of a league apart or a league within a league, as the most attractive teams, the teams that when you check your television listings on Sunday morning, you want to see more than any other.
So what was your approach to making them larger than life for this purpose?
Well, two things, really. One is that we used to open each broadcast with a kind of a mini movie, if you will, dramatic music and dramatic narration from Pat Summerall, and extreme close-ups of players with the emotion of the game evident on their faces to try to sell personalities and sell the collective mystique of a given team or two. The other thing in that regard was John Madden's terrific ability to seize on a player or a player's personality and make that player, even though he might be quite an ordinary player in a coach's terms, John had an ability to make Bill Bates, for instance, a safety with the Dallas Cowboys, who'd been a free agent, not drafted by any teams. But John liked the way he crashed into kickoff wedges and threw his body around on the field. And John nicknamed him Bully Bill Bates. Went back and found out that his grade school teacher in sixth grade had written on his report card, "Bill Bates is the bully of the schoolyard." And so John called him Bully Bill Bates, even though he was about my size. He was 5'10 and 170 pounds or so.
I figured that while you were busy trying to make myths for the camera, that behind the camera you were doing a lot of debunking.
How do you mean?
Well, that you'd probably make a lot of fun of the myths you'd created.
Oh, I don't know. It would be a manipulation if we'd done that. And I must say that when you're involved in that process, it's different now. I have a longer perspective on it. But when you're involved and you're in that tunnel, doing a game every week and meeting with Joe Montana and Bill Walsh and Tom Landry, you really come to believe that their rivalries are your rivalries and their emotions are yours and their passion is yours. So when you get on the air Sunday, it's not a manipulation at all for you to convey that. I think we convinced ourselves it was holy war on Sundays.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the sportscasters that you've worked with. You created the team of Pat Summerall and John Madden. What did you see in them that you thought would work together?
You know, we knew that Madden in 1981 would be our new number one analyst. There was a debate, however, within CBS about whether Pat Summerall or Vin Scully was right to partner him. And Scully, while my colleagues argued is a more elegant broadcaster, perhaps, was a man who needed much of the microphone in order to be effective. And Madden, of course, is among the most expansive broadcasters in sports. And I argued that together it would be a pairing that would just wear the viewer out within 3 weeks, whereas Summerall is so spare and so economical that he'd be the right stylist, the right partner for John. And after some debate within the division, we won that argument.
There's a scene in the movie Broadcast News that you say in your new book you really relate to, and I'm thinking of the scene where William Hurt is broadcasting from a breaking news story, and Holly Hunter is basically whispering in his ear what to say and what questions to ask the newsmakers that he's interviewing, and after the broadcast is over, William Hurt says to Holly Hunter, "You know just when to feed me the lines." Now, this apparently is the kind of position you were in a lot, producing sports, feeding things to the announcers. What kinds of things would you have to tell them?
Terry, it was sometimes a matter of seeing a pass route in isolation, for instance, and even before the replay, telling Madden, for instance, "John, watch this post-corner move," or "John, it's a pattern called the shake that we were told about yesterday by Joe Montana," which enabled Madden to actually preview or anticipate the replay for the viewer. And while he may or may not have seen it himself from the booth, it enabled him to look like an absolute omniscient genius up there, having seen all the play and the individual matchups on every sequence, even before the viewer saw it on the replay. It only added to his legend as the authority in pro football.
Did the opposite ever happen, where you told him something that was incorrect and he felt like an idiot?
That's happened to me in my career, but not with John. By the time I got to that point, I knew, and every producer knows, that his credibility and the commentator's willingness to repeat your information is totally contingent upon your 100% delivery of accuracy in every situation. Because, of course, when the commentator makes a mistake, he's not able to say, or we don't super on the screen, "That mistake came to you from the producer, Terry O'Neill." So by the time I got to CBS, I knew it was critical that I be certain in every situation.
What's an example of an error that you made before?
Oh, you'll enjoy this. When I was a statistician at ABC for Monday Night Football, just after I'd finished my Olympic research duties and I was going to graduate school, I was sitting in Frank Gifford's side with a team of Gifford, Meredith, and Cosell. And one night in Philadelphia, as the Eagles were attempting to score late in the half, I told Frank that the Eagles had no more timeouts left. And so in a pause during their last timeout, Frank went into a long explanation about how they'd have to throw the next pass either into the end zone or to the sideline because they didn't have time to stop the clock in case they completed a pass in the middle of the field. Well, don't you know that on the next snap, the Eagle receiver took about a 10-yard pass down to about the 5-yard line, and he jumped up having caught the ball and signaled for timeout, and the official gave it to him, and Frank chilled me with a look. He's a very nice man and been a friend a long time, but he has never looked at me quite like he did in that moment, and I certainly deserved it.
Let's talk a little bit about how television has changed sports. One of the complaints that you hear sometimes is that games are now played for the cameras and not for the fans in the stands.
I think it's accurate to some degree, although, interestingly, the United States Football League, the spring league that lasted just 3 years in the early 80s, failed in large measure because when you saw the game on television, there was no one in the stands, and therefore the viewer in his subconscious, or maybe his conscious mind, decided this must not be important. If there are not full stadiums there and no one to see it, how important can it be? Is it worth my time?
Another criticism that you frequently hear about how network sports has changed television is that the time of the game is created not for the convenience of the athlete or for the convenience of the people in the stands, but rather for the broadcast. So on certain games, whether it's East Coast or West Coast, it's going to be played at a certain time, you know, one set time, and it might be really inconvenient for the people in that location.
You know, this is one that I think is ultimately defensible if you understand that the players are now making scores of money beyond what they ever would have dreamed before television. The average NBA player, the average player, is now making $700,000 a year. Just 20 years ago, that same average player was making $9,000 a year. I think the truth is it's not terribly inconvenient for television to dictate certain kickoff and play ball schedules. And interestingly, at the Seoul Olympics here just last year, when NBC tried to dictate the start of track and field events because Seoul was 14 hours different from New York. It was rebuffed by the International Track and Field Federation. Likewise, in swimming and volleyball and several other sports, television did not have its way, and the decisions were made on the welfare of the athlete.
Do you think that the pacing of games is ever affected by the demands of the television broadcast?
They are, but athletes have come to not only to recognize that, but to use the time effectively. Basketball coaches, for instance, will tell you that they know there'll be a television timeout every 4 or 5 minutes on the game clock, and therefore they make their decisions about when to take their own timeouts, knowing that they'll have these other stoppages. Many times they can save their own timeouts for the end of the game and use the TV timeouts to rest players and do strategy because they know when they're coming.
The networks aren't in this game alone anymore. There's a lot of competition now from cable. As a matter of fact, as an independent producer, you produce frequently for cable now. What impact do you think this is having on network sports?
It's Terry. The single biggest impact is the erosion of audience. When I first got into the business, we'd sit down in programming meetings and know that we could offer some weak programming occasionally, knowing that the audience had nowhere else to go. And especially if we tucked a weak program between two stronger ones, we often got away with it. Now, if you don't give the audience something it wants to see, it can go and find cable and syndicated programming, and even more alarming, it can find other things to do. During the football strike of 1982 and 1987, the networks found in a dramatic way that people were able to get through the fall of the year, believe it or not, without watching football every Sunday. And so it's made it tougher in terms of the need to offer quality programming at all times if one wants to attract an audience.
What's the difference in the amount of money that baseball and football make for the networks?
In terms of profit?
Yeah.
When I was at CBS in 5 years, as we mentioned in the book, NFL football made CBS $91.8 million. CBS has just signed a baseball agreement, which begins next year, for $1.08 billion for 4 years of baseball. And already its executives are admitting it will lose in the area of $20 to $40 million a year on that. Even before the first pitch is thrown, they're making that admission. But they've done so poorly in primetime entertainment programming lately that they feel it's necessary to, in effect, purchase dominance in the month of October when they've bought the League Championship Series and the World Series.
Since the networks have to bid for contracts, Do you ever feel that commentators can't really be as critical of the people in the sport as they might like to be for fear of alienating the league and losing a contract?
Yeah, there's no question. In this respect, sports television is an embarrassment to those of us who like to think we could practice a little journalism there. Take the recent NCAA basketball tournament. If you watch CBS's 60 Hours, you would think that every student athlete is going to class with regularity. Everyone is progressing toward a degree, that when the games finish at the end of March, they're all headed back to the classroom. And yet in the very same weeks that you're watching this fantasy on television, you're seeing a Time magazine cover story about the ills of college athletics called the College Trap. The New York Times is editorializing, calling college athletics a cesspool, and yet CBS, when you tune it in, it's like going to see a fantasy movie. You have to suspend belief for the 2 hours that you're watching the game, because what you're hearing has no touch and no relevance to reality at all.
Well, how do you feel about having been one of the people who created the fantasy?
Well, I have to say that one of the reasons I'm no longer in network television is because I frequently rebelled at that fantasy, and it made for controversy and contention all along the way between me and my bosses. I ultimately pushed to the wall on many of these subjects, would take my own career in my hands and report the truth. Knowing that the reaction from a rights holder might indeed be enough to get me fired.
You are now the head of your own sports TV production company. Do you ever miss the high pressure and the big games that you covered for the networks?
I really don't, Terry. I must tell you that if you do it long enough and you try very hard while you're doing it, once you've left it, it's quite easy to decompress and to know that you took a very full swing at it and you left behind some good people, and perhaps you trained some people and put good systems in place, and that they're now doing what you once did. I think if you take any less than that sort of approach to it, you might leave with misgivings or regrets, but no, I have none, whatever.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
You're kind to have me. Thank you.